Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and on this episode, my co-presenter John Dorney talks to Dr. Conor Mulva about the history of the Irish Parliamentary Party. Conor Mulva is a lecturer in UCD and an editorial assistant at Documents of Irish Foreign Policy. If you would like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, go to the Near FM podcast page or like us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/The Irish History Show.
Conor Mulva, you have been researching the Irish Parliamentary Party or the Home Rule Party. Can you say, first of all, how you got interested in that topic?
I started back in 2006 looking at the Irish Volunteers and specifically at the split that occurred in the Irish Volunteers in September of 1914 between Owen McNeill's Irish Volunteers, which then went on to stage the Easter Rising, and then Redmond's Volunteers. That big split and how that split came about, how John Redmond installed his own nominees onto the Provisional Committee of the Irish Volunteers during the summer of 1914. And then I did some more research on John Redmond's relationship with the Catholic bishops from 1906 up until his own death in 1918. For my own doctoral thesis, I looked at the Irish Parliamentary Party as a whole, as an entire entity.
What was the Irish Parliamentary Party and how was it founded?
Okay, so going right back, I suppose, to Isaac Butt and the foundation of the Home Government Association in 1870, the party began as a movement that wanted to bring government back to Ireland, simply the concept of home rule. While everyone would be familiar with the concept of home rule, that desire to work within the constitutional parameters to bring home governance back to Ireland, that was one strand of home rule, and that was, I suppose, the publicly trumpeted side of home rule. But from a very early period, and from the entry of people like Joseph Biggar into the home rule movement in the mid-1870s, the home rule movement did link into a more radical tradition in Irish nationalism, namely Fenianism. And from there, it linked into the land question, which I suppose we could link back to Daniel O'Connell in that this was a means of popularising what was quite an esoteric concept of home rule, but making this movement more relevant to the people of Ireland by linking it into the land question. So famously, Charles Stuart Parnell said that I would have never taken off my coat and rolled up my sleeves on the land question if I did not know that it was for the furtherance of Irish home rule and home governance. So,
was the land question the same thing in many people's minds as the national question?
One scholar that's done some excellent work on this is Michael Wheatley, who in a later period has looked at provincial Irish nationalism and the linkages between, let's say, the upper echelons of the home rule movement, the concept of Redmondism, which Wheatley says was a more conciliatory form of nationalism, which was more imperialistic. It was, I suppose, it links into a Catholic loyalism that goes right back to the Confederation of Kilkenny, where Catholicism and a loyalty to the crown as opposed to the English Parliament was still something that was contiguous and was able to exist in parallel. So that was a theme that came into the upper crust of the Irish Parliamentary Party in the early 20th century. But underneath that, the substrate of Irish nationalism and the vast bulk of Irish nationalists at a provincial level were still, in Wheatley's own words, steeped in Catholicity, a sense of victimhood and an antipathy towards England. So in that sense, there was no real shift in the bulk of Irish nationalists. They never became the same as their leadership as the movement progressed into the 20th century, but they did, I suppose, link the two movements. So again, it's a tricky subject. It's one that it's very hard to explain how those linkages occur, but there is a recruitment of people from a land background, going right back to Michael Davitt, let's say, into the home rule question. And really, their desire within the movement is to advance the liberation of the people in a more tangible sense. And one key figure in that would be William O'Brien, who reinvigorates the entire Irish constitutional movement in 1898 when he founds the United Irish League, which becomes the grassroots organisation of Irish nationalism after that point.
Mm-hmm. Just to stay on the land question and the land war for a second, once upon a time I saw a picture of the reservoir in Wicklow when there was a drought and it emptied. There had been a village there before which had flooded when they built the reservoir. But on one of the houses there was a graffiti, "No evictions, God save Ireland."
Very good, yes.
Can you explain this kind of, on a popular level, how people saw this kind of...
Well, I don't know about the Sobaqua Blessington example, but it's certainly, that's an excellent anecdote. I hadn't heard that one before. On a popular level, I think the whole point is that people were much more radical, much less conciliatory, and that this notion of a home rule party that was fully constitutional never really existed on the ground. Captain Moonlight, as in the concept of agitation, of protecting one's own land, of antipathy to landlordism in its most, the concept of exploitative landlordism, that's not how it existed on the ground, but this caricature of landlordism that was often portrayed by the Land League was something that motivated people on the ground. It was how people interpreted their own struggle in the context of home rule. And I think one of the most illustrative things on this comes in a later period, in 1912, or Home Rule Bill in 1912, was met with very much, I suppose, a sense of apathy in provincial Ireland. And this is seen in admittedly biased police reports. The police collected monthly reports of every single county and district in Ireland and reported back up their chain of command. And in these, one particular example, but this can be brought on a nationwide basis, Kilkenny, which would be seen as part of that more sedate, less sectarian part of Ireland where Catholic and Protestant farmers lived more in tandem and more in harmony than they did, let's say, in Connacht. In this particular part of Ireland, it was seen that there was great apathy towards the Home Rule Bill. And the thing that really motivated farmers at that time was the National Insurance Act, under which they were allowed to incorporate themselves and begin to get into social insurance. So in some senses, the Home Rule issue never really motivated the Irish peasantry, for lack of a better term, but Irish tenant farmers, let's say, once they had solved the land question, and that can be traced back to 1903, really, with George Wyndham's Land Act, which was the most expansive and the most decisive of the land acts. Once the land question was solved, then they had very little reason to push forward with home rule. They were quite satisfied with their lot by that point.
Many of us know about the land war in the 1870s and 1880s, and this was mainly to stop evictions and to put a halt on rents and eventually to subsidise buying out land. But in the early 20th century, there was another episode which the party was involved in called the Ranch War. Can you explain what that was?
1906, centering around the figure of Lawrence Ginnell in Westmeath, Roscommon, and that area around the Midlands there, Ginnell began to become quite central to a new agitation, which was around the clearing of lands for the creation of large ranches or grazing pasture land and the removal of large amounts of tillage farmers. Interestingly, even though the Liberal government was in power in 1906, the Ranch War led to the imprisonment of various different figures, including Ginnell, who was then a Home Rule MP. Now, Ginnell subsequently left the party, and he was always a maverick within the Home Rule Party. He eventually became Sinn Féin MP and one of the very few individuals who made that unusual transition from Home Rule to Sinn Féin, although it's not unique. So from 1906 to 1909, there was widespread agitation in the Midlands around this ranch issue, or the ranch war, as it was referred to. There was land agitation, there was cattle maiming, there was intimidation, particularly one of the most famous forms of intimidation, and one that's quite low level, I think, in the grand scheme of things, and that's the threatening letter. William Vaughan has written about this extensively in his writings on the land war and said that studies of the threatening letter are one of the most interesting ways to get into the land question, because this was often the first resort of somebody who felt downtrodden or hard done by a landlord. They would write them a threatening letter, usually with an unusual pseudonym like Rory of the Hills or something like this, and threaten that if they weren't given a more fair deal, or they weren't given a good deal on their land, they would let some cattle loose or drive some cattle or agitate in some other way.
Which goes right back to the 18th century.
Exactly. This shows there's clear continuity between the 19th and 20th century in these terms.
Now, in the land war, you can see how you could frame it as a nationalist issue, because most of the land was still owned by, let's say, the Anglo-Irish class, which did have some connection back to the 17th century and colonisation. Is that true? Is that still true in the Ranch War at the time?
The concept that landlords were Anglo-Irish, Protestant and inherently evil has been, I suppose, been debunked to a certain extent. A large portion of landholding was in Catholic hands, even by the late 19th century. However, I suppose you can find notable examples, particularly out in Connacht and even in Donegal, of these rack-renting landlords, these notorious cases. But by and large, they weren't representative of the vast majority of landlords. In general, the crisis of land, if this, that this is to go away from the ranch war, but to go back to the economic crisis of 1878, 1879, which isn't dissimilar from the crisis we find ourselves in today, this was a crisis where global falls in agricultural produce prices led to a collapse of the entire system of rent collection of land holding and led to a spiraling of evictions in that period. So even in that period, the problem was that landlords weren't making the most of their investments. They weren't reinvesting the money that they did get from rent into the land. And eventually the amount that they were actually collecting in rent began to diminish as people fell into arrears, and then their entire system of land holding fell apart. But certainly the original land war is much more nuanced than I suppose we would sometimes see it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my point is, though, it's possible to see it in that light.
Yes.
It's become a nationalist issue.
The important thing here is that this was a propaganda campaign that was picked up on by the Land League, and via the Land League, the entire Home Rule movement. And they portrayed this as part of a dualistic struggle between good and evil, between landlord and tenant, between home ruler and Anglo-Irish.
Cromwell and...
Exactly, yes, yes. And this is again where we see linkages between radicalism and home rule, because they do try and cast Ireland in black and white when it's a much more subtle shade of grey in the period.
You have almost these gentlemen, members of parliament, who want home rule and it's all very constitutional, and then you've got people writing threatening letters and threatening landlords and what have you. The linkage between the two one of the linkages is these two organisations on the ground in the early 20th century, the United Irish League and the Ancient Order of Hibernians. Can you say something about them?
The grassroots Irish nationalism is a fascinating subject, and I think it does get to the heart of explaining the disconnect between parliamentarians and provincial agitators. One thing that we have to bear in mind is that the personnel of the Home Rule Party changed significantly, particularly moving into the 1880s when a landed Protestant class were purged from the Irish Parliamentary Party. I'm thinking here not only of Isaac Butt, who certainly wasn't landed in any sense, but more William Shaw and his purge by Parnell. When Parnell took over the party in the 1880s, he began to promote not so much tenant farmers into the party, but more publicans, journalists, and other such, I suppose we would say, the petty bourgeoisie of provincial Ireland, because farmers, and particularly tenant farmers, couldn't extract themselves from the land for long periods of time to go over to Westminster. So, and this was a trend that continued into the 1890s and into the 20th century. The United Irish League in the 20th century controlled candidate selection at grassroots level, and therefore there was a shift, particularly up to 1906, of new men into the Irish Parliamentary Party. But one of the key points is that the leadership of the Irish Parliamentary Party remained in the hands of the lieutenants of Parnell back from the 1880s. That never changed. So John Redmond, John Dillon, T.P. O'Connor, and then dissidents who remained very much central to Irish nationalism, Tim Healy, William O'Brien, these kind of people remained very much at the centre, at the upper echelons of the party, and really the functioning of the new men in the party and of, I suppose, the rank and file of the Irish Parliamentary Party more generally was simply to do as their party pledge urged them to do, which was to sit, act and vote with the party. And once those particular obligations were fulfilled, they were free to do as they wanted, but they never had a role in policy steering.
Mm-hmm. So if the United Irish League is something like a membership organisation or, you know, party organisation like we have now, what about the Ancient Order of Hibernians?
The Ancient Order of Hibernians are a very funny lot. There isn't just the Ancient Order of Hibernians. There's also groups like the National Foresters. And in some ways, we could talk about the different groups at local level as 40 Shades of Green across Ireland. There were various different affiliates to the national organisation. In one sense, the reason for this was because the Irish Parliamentary Party had a model which kept them at the top of Irish politics, which was that when any new movement was created, and the United Irish League is the prime example of this, if it threatened their hegemony at the top of Irish politics, they would assimilate the movement, they would incorporate it, they would consume it, and then they would, I suppose, mollify it to the point that it was no longer a threat. That was done very effectively with the United Irish League. Its founder, William O'Brien, was eventually purged out of the Irish Parliamentary Party, first in 1903, then he was invited back in, and then he was famously, unceremoniously thrown out of a party convention in 1909 by the Ancient Order of Hibernians. To get back to the Ancient Order of Hibernians and their specific role, they could probably be seen as a green-orange order, let's say. They were a gentleman's organisation, they had benevolent works associated with them, they also had a system of clubhouses and branches throughout the country. So they were almost like nationalist Freemasons. From the early part of the 20th century, they were led by Joseph Devlin, who was the MP for West Belfast. And Devlin didn't have, he was a good orator, but he wasn't noted as being an orator. His real claim to fame was that he was the most skilled organiser of the entire Irish Parliamentary Party. And through the Ancient Order of Hibernians, he wielded a large amount of control, which was harnessed by John Redmond and John Dillon as the two mainstays at the top of the Irish Parliamentary Party. So the Ancient Order of Hibernians wasn't just a gentleman's club, let's say. It wasn't just a means of associating people and articulating nationalism at a local level. It was also the strong arm of the Irish Parliamentary Party. And opponents of the Irish Parliamentary Party, particularly the William O'Briens and the Tim Healy's, were very much angered by the use of the Ancient Order of Hibernians to muscle in on meetings, to control their proceedings, and to stamp out dissent within the entire nationalist movement at grassroots and parliamentary level.
From, say, the 1890s, especially when there's local government acts passed and they get more power, I mean, in some ways, the IPP becomes a little bit like a one-party state in the south of Ireland. Is that fair?
I think that's a fair enough assessment. I'd be cautious about calling it a one-party state, but it definitely has almost universal control of local government from 1898 with the Local Government Act, which does fundamentally change the system of local government in Ireland. It's been said that local government provided the training ground for the politicians that eventually inherited the state in 1922. So there was an element that at local level, dissidents, whether they be Sinn Féiners in a later period or from the Healy O'Brien camp in an earlier period, did have a chance to get onto these councils. But famously, if we think back to Ulysses and James Joyce, Councillor Nannetti strolling around Dublin, this is the personification of local government in Ireland. People like Lawrence Sherlock, who were Lord Mayor of Dublin for a significant period in the early 20th century, these people were local bosses. They were the Tammany Hall bosses of Irish politics, and they ran things very effectively. They were known for being quite corrupt. In 1913, a Royal Commission of Inquiry into landlord tenement holdings in Dublin found that a significant portion of Dublin city councillors, most of them Irish Party or Irish Nationalist, held between them, I think, in the region of 80 tenement buildings in Dublin. And therefore, there were significant linkages between corruption and the Irish Parliamentary Party at local level. Now, that didn't quite permeate through to the highest echelons of the party, if we want to talk about corruption, and that's a term we have to be careful in defining in this period. But certainly, I know in 1906, in the Irish Parliamentary Party minutes, a resolution is passed that no member of the Irish Parliamentary Party can see a deputation without receiving the approval of the party leadership, because it seems that individual parliamentarians were doling out patronage, sorting out local appointments, things like this at grassroots level, and this was cause for concern.
Mm-hmm. And they got some competition quite late in the day as regards to the party's history from the All for Ireland League, and they reacted in a way which was not particularly democratic. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, this is a very interesting chapter in the Irish Parliamentary Party's history. Moving away from the reformation of the party in 1900, when all the disparate elements that had split over the 1890s and famously never got on, they finally got together in 1900 because of the threat of William O'Brien's United Irish League. And they decided that if the Irish Parliamentary Party wasn't going to be usurped entirely, they would have to put aside all their petty differences and form one united party again. And as I said, eventually consuming the United Irish League and then mollifying it and turning it into an organ of the party. So in making this grand alliance, people who really didn't get on were put into the same party. Tim Healy was, I would say, the most prickly of the constitutional Irish nationalists of the entire period. And he famously didn't get on with John Dillon. He didn't particularly one could say he might not have got on with anyone. But Healy was a law unto himself. He was a clerical candidate and a clerical politician. And by the end of 1900, 1901, he's out of the Irish Parliamentary Party. By the end of 1903, William O'Brien is out of the Irish Parliamentary Party. So there are these various figures who had been incorporated and then purged out again. In 1909, in reaction to the rise of Sinn Féin, and particularly the North Leitrim by-election of 1908, when the party had to really rethink its tactics because it couldn't consume Sinn Féin. Arthur Griffiths refused to be consumed. He said, we will exist as an entity outside of this great Irish party umbrella, and we will propose a new system, which was abstention. It was the one thing that couldn't be incorporated into the Irish Parliamentary Party message, because going to Parliament was elemental to their whole campaign. So in 1908, they re-invited in Healy and O'Brien and all their followers. These were already dissidents. Some of them had gone towards Sinn Féin and then were incorporated into this new movement. But in 1909, William O'Brien attempted to get certain resolutions passed at the great convention of the United Irish League, which was the caucus of the entire Irish Parliamentary Party. And when he was shouted down, when his supporters were literally baton-charged by members of the Ancient Order of Hibernians, reputedly trained in from Belfast for the day by Joseph Devlin, so very much the strong arm of the party. After this, then that circle around William O'Brien began to form what we could term as a Munster dissident force. They didn't become the All-for-Ireland League until April of 1910, and it was only at that point that Tim Healy finally agreed to join forces with William O'Brien. William O'Brien was quite well known as an anti-clerical, and Tim Healy had the backing of Archbishop Cardinal Michael Logan in Armagh. So two very different figures. And really their alliance was, I suppose, an all but the Irish Parliamentary Party alliance. The thing that they saw eye to eye on most was that they didn't like Redmondism, they didn't like Devlinism, and they certainly didn't like the Ancient Order of Hibernians. So they formed a new group. The MPs that went on to become the All-for-Ireland League in April of 1910 had already seen an election in January of 1910. Famously, 1910 had two elections because of the constitutional crisis opened up by the People's Budget and Lloyd George. So in that first election, there was a good showing. Healy had clung on to a seat in North Louth, and the people who would eventually become the All-for-Ireland League showed well in Munster, particularly around Cork. D.D. Sheehan was one of the notable candidates down there. And as well, they had some interesting candidates. Morton Frewen was an unusual character in that he wasn't really a home ruler at all, but he was incorporated under the All-for-Ireland League umbrella because they needed supporters.
You had this new force, the All-for-Ireland League, mainly in Cork. What I'm getting at, I guess, is that the Irish Parliamentary Party, sometimes portrayed as the constitutional party, the democratic party, they tried to, in some cases, beat these people off the streets in these elections.
Yes. Irish Parliamentary Party certainly weren't democratic. From its very inception, the Irish Parliamentary Party, or let's say the Home Rule movement in a more general sense, had at its core efficiency. It was a party machine. It was a parliamentary machine. It was also a machine at constituency level in terms of candidate selection. It said that the candidate selection meetings were essentially a rubber stamping affair, and that all the real business had been done by members of the Irish Parliamentary Party, whether that be the central executive in Dublin or whether that be local magnates. So they were never particularly democratic. Even in Parliament, a democratic party, we might imagine, is a party that would go in and observe parliamentary procedure. But in the House of Commons at all times, the Irish Parliamentary Party flirted with obstructionism. In the 1880s, this obstructionism was overt, it was militant, and it was quite effective. It did quite literally grind the business of the House of Commons to a halt for a period. But also, in the early 20th century, something which I suppose we could call neo-obstructionism, a more low level of not wanting to play the parliamentary game, certainly in terms of asking barrages of question in Parliament and blocking up the business again, but more so by using procedures rather than the earlier phase of obstruction, which was long, long speeches. So they weren't democratic in Parliament, and they certainly weren't democratic on the grounds. It was a single-issue party in many senses, or maybe a dual-issue party, in that its two pillars of policy were land and the Home Rule question. And once those objectives were being pursued and being pursued successfully, they didn't really care whether they were democratic. They certainly wanted to preserve the notion of democracy. They certainly wanted to preserve the notion that they were an inclusive party, that they were reasonable individuals, and that, I suppose, the edifices of respectability, from candidate selection to a very surface level transparency, they were preserved within the party. But what the central executive of the Irish Parliamentary Party said went, by and large. It was a party where discipline was rigid. And this again goes back to the Irish Party pledge. By having a pledge in the party, they ensured that the party was the most disciplined in the House of Commons when it started. And other parties in the House of Commons began to mimic the structures and the behaviour of the Irish Parliamentary Party as they went on, because they realised just how efficient a modern machine-based party could be.
We skirted around the religion a little bit. What was the relationship of the party to the Catholic Church in Ireland?
Do you know, I've written a whole thesis on this, and I'm still not sure if I quite understand it. It's a very difficult relationship. It's not one that's easily explicable, and that might have to do with sources, because from a religious perspective, certain things aren't written down, and certain sources, without being sensationalist about this, I would argue that there is a degree of sanitization within those sources. Much of the business was conducted orally, face-to-face. Famously in 1911, 1912, the Bishop of Ross, Dennis Kelly, had sat on the Primrose Commission, which was to inquire into the finances of Ireland prior to setting up a Home Rule Bill. And he invited John Redmond and John Dillon down to his Archbishop's Palace in Skibbereen so that they could discuss the content of the financial provisions in private and with the utmost discretion. And he reported them in his letter. He said, "My housekeeper is trained not to blab, and the local papers don't ever publish anything without my express permission." So it just shows you how much of a cloak of secrecy existed in this period when it comes to the church and the Home Rule Party. But in general, the relationship was, I would say, it was quite good. The thing is that we can't look at the church as a monolithic entity in this period. Cardinal Logue famously didn't get on with, I would argue, any of the Irish Parliamentary Party. He certainly didn't get on with Joseph Devlin. And even though the Ancient Order of Hibernians is seen as an organisation that's very Catholic, it was one that Cardinal Logue himself didn't like at all. And when it came to discussing partition with Cardinal Logue around 1913, they couldn't send Joseph Devlin as the obvious candidate. He was the most senior nationalist politician from Ulster. He was the MP for West Belfast. But he wasn't sent down to Cardinal Logue because himself and Logue just did not get on. So Cardinal Logue was someone that didn't get on with the Parliamentary Party much at all. Meanwhile, Cardinal Logue, one of his closest colleagues, is the Bishop of Raphoe, just there, based in Letterkenny. And that was Patrick O'Donnell. And he was one of the strongest supporters of the Irish Parliamentary Party. He had been one of the secretaries, one of the trustees of the Irish Parliamentary Party election fund from 1900. So he was involved in party finances. He was a close confidant of John Redmond. He was a supporter of John Redmond. Similarly, we could put Dennis Kelly of Ross into that category with his relations with the party over the Third Home Rule Bill. And then similarly, the Bishop of Waterford and Lismore was another bishop who was sympathetic towards the Irish Parliamentary Party. In 1907, he had been the secretary to the bishop's conclave in Maynooth, and he corresponded extensively with Redmond over the 1907 Factory and Workshops Bill, because the bishops were very concerned that Catholic convent laundries, as in Magdalen laundries, would be included within that bracket, that they would fall under government inspection in 1907. So the Catholic bishops wrote to Redmond to ensure that laundries and convent laundries would be exempted from this, which, you know, in a broader sense, I suppose, points to issues and problems within the church going right back to the early part of the last century and politicians' role in that. So there's a lot to be discussed there. But then other bishops, Bishop Dwyer of Limerick was, I suppose, the most radical of the bishops, and he was the closest you could have to a Sinn Féin bishop by 1917 when he himself died. And similarly, Archbishop Walsh of Dublin had a very complicated relationship with constitutional nationalism, because he had been very prominent in the 1890s at the trial of Parnell, and particularly around his divorce scandal. He was one of the strongest bishops to come out against Parnell, and therefore Redmond had to work very hard to reconcile himself with Archbishop Walsh. I would argue he'd largely done that by 1912, but still, I suppose there was tension there between those two.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess things that seemed incredibly obvious to people at the time, which was that both the Home Rule Party and the Catholic Church were both trying to represent the Irish Catholic community, seemed a little bit strange to us, though. I mean, we don't have the same immediate identification between politics and religion.
Certainly, church and state in that period is, as you say, it's more naturally linked. I think that probably goes back to O'Connellism and emancipation, and that's where constitutional methods and the Catholic Church become fused. The Irish Parliamentary Party existed at its most basic level on a parish basis. So, you know, we shouldn't read into that too much. But at the same time, the church and the parish pump were central to Irish Parliamentary Party organisation. And it wasn't seen as problematic that, let's say, local curates would have a role in candidate selection. That was seen as natural and par for the course. However, we shouldn't see the Irish Parliamentary Party as a Catholic party, despite all of this. When the political circumstances required it, John Redmond was quite content to tell the bishops that he wouldn't represent them in Parliament. Famously, in late 1912, when he was asked to make representations on behalf of the bishops regarding the Third Home Rule Bill, and particularly education and the provisions for denominational education within that bill, and he said, "It's too late in the day. If I'm to go into the House of Commons and try and speak as an advocate of the Catholic Church, it will unleash all the anti-Catholic sentiment of England, and that's not something I'm willing to contemplate." So he was quite content to say no when it suited him. Redmond's second wife was an English Protestant. And again, this gets back to the point that at the apex of the Irish Parliamentary Party, at the very top of the party, they were much more conciliatory. They weren't steeped in that sense of Catholicism and victimhood that existed at the provincial level. So the party was much more gentlemanlike and much more similar, particularly to English liberalism, once you got to the top, but without the non-conformist streaks of English liberalism, which the Irish Catholic Church had so much problems with.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm going to fit in one more question on that. But
of course, yeah.
Where did that leave Protestant Irish nationalists? And there were Protestant nationalists.
Absolutely. One of the key Protestant Irish nationalists of the period I look at was Stephen Gwynne, who was not only John Redmond's first biographer, but a very important home ruler in Cork in the period. And Colin Reid's biography of Stephen Gwynne has gone a long way to explaining how those layers of identity existed. But I don't think we should see Ireland in this period as black and white between nationalist Catholic and then loyalist Protestant, let's say. That's simply not how the state existed. The tradition of Protestant nationalism, particularly in South Leinster, which I would see as its heartland, going back to Parnell and other figures, ways in which Protestant nationalism in that Wexford Wicklow gentry existed. It wasn't so black and white. Certainly, there was no question that Protestants could see themselves as nationalistic. We only have to think of Douglas Hyde, of W.B. Yeats, of Sam Maguire, of these figures. So they were central to articulating different versions of Irish nationalism. And similarly, you had Unionist Catholics. So particularly in Dublin, where figures like, and he's a Protestant himself, but Brian Rico Cooper was elected to South Dublin in 1910, presumably by a large section of the Catholic middle class who saw unionism as preferable and a system that they worked well within. So no, it would be entirely wrong to look at this as a dualistic system. There was a much cross currents, and there were several layers of identity that could safely coexist, not only within the Irish Parliamentary Party, but also within movements like the IRB, let's say. And Roger Casement, I think, is probably the, although not your typical IRB man, but certainly...
Ernest Blythe, though.
Ernest Blythe would be...
And Hobson.
Yes, well, Hobson is a key one, again, in bringing forward the revolutionary tradition into the 20th century. So
when we get to 1912, one reading of history is that the Irish Parliamentary Party actually sort of wins, but it's snatched away from them, because they win Home Rule, which is what they'd always wanted, and then circumstances conspired to snatch it away. How good a deal really was Home Rule in terms of Irish independence? Was it the goal at the end of the day that they wanted?
The third Home Rule Bill represented a legislative landmine in that it contained within it many future problems that any Irish Parliament would have had problems invariably with finance, because the finance provisions of the Home Rule Bill were punitive, they were problematic, and they were poorly drafted. Similarly, in terms of religious tolerance and the safeguards that were built in, the Catholic Church themselves concluded that they had much room for manoeuvre within the proposed legislation. So there were dangers again there that, I suppose, Home Rule may lead to a degree of Rome Rule, not through the Irish Parliamentary Party, but through the fact that the Church saw this room for manoeuvre. I suppose it could be seen as a stepping stone towards greater independence, just as the 1922 settlement became for both of the Civil War parties. And as such, it was something that could be built upon. There's no question about that. But it was a compromise that was acceptable to the Irish Parliamentary Party. Going back to the other group we mentioned earlier, the All for Ireland League, they were much more sanguine in their interpretation of the Home Rule Bill, particularly on elements like finance, where they were very cagey about how this would actually play out in fact. So not everyone was overly thrilled with the Home Rule Bill, but there was a sense that this is the best offer we can get, and we should work toward. Where problems began to arise was with partition. The Home Rule Bill, as it existed in April of 1912 when it was introduced, had two major problems in it. Finance in terms of what was in the bill, and Ulster in terms of the fact that it was entirely left out. There was no mention of special consideration for the northeast of Ireland. There was special consideration for religious minorities, but there was no special consideration for the economic unicality of Ulster, particularly the Belfast region. So these were all problems that would have been encountered down the line if Home Rule had have come into tangible effect. And something we have to remember is that the Home Rule Bill did make it to the statute book in September of 1914. So in a sense, it was a law. It was the Government of Ireland Act 1914. It's just that that act was passed in conjunction with an amending act, which meant it never came into law.
To be clear though, I mean, the 1922 treaty allowed the Irish Free State, which was partitioned of course, but allowed it to collect its own taxes, that their own army, that their own police, their own postal service. None of that was an offer in 1912.
Absolutely. The 1922 settlement was vastly more extensive, and I think that really speaks of the immense amount of social change, of political change that occurred in Ireland in that decade between 1912 and 1922. However, the Home Rule Bill, as you said, had many flaws to it and many restrictions. The Bishop of Ross said that the financial clauses of the Home Rule Bill made Ireland not master of its house, but merely a mistress, given an allowance for the upkeep of the house every year, but with no real control over what to do with it. As you say, in terms of police, that was another major problem with the Home Rule Bill, in that these kind of powers, the powers that we would nowadays expect any constituent part of a Commonwealth to have, they simply were not given to the Irish state. There were provisions for some of these to be handed over after a duration of time. And again, that points to the stepping stone aspect of the Third Home Rule Bill, that it was a bill that gave Ireland a certain degree of independence and said, if you can do well with this, we will give you more. And there were provisions written in for even the handover of police powers by I think, a six-year period after the conclusion of the bill. But crucially, finance was something that was held in check. A state has to be able to collect its own taxes. It has to be able to determine which taxes it can raise and which it can lower. The Irish state is entirely the wrong word. The Irish Home Rule Parliament, as it was proposed in 1912, could really only raise taxes in two areas, and that was on duties, so on beer, whiskey and spirits, or on land. And these were both very difficult issues for any government to do, particularly in a system where publicans and politicians, going back to my point about the entry of publicans rather than tenant farmers in the 1880s, so that was a contentious issue if spirits or beer taxes were to be raised. And that was something that the All for Ireland League had a big problem with in 1910, when the Irish Parliamentary Party had to compromise on Lloyd George's People's Budget, which proposed extensive new indirect taxes on particularly alcohol. Similarly, the land question was a no-go area, I would argue, for any Irish politicians, because land was so sacrosanct in Irish political culture. So they had very little manoeuvre room in terms of taxation, and really they were at the mercy of British taxation.
Home Rule was pretty popular in 1912, despite whatever flaws it had. And yet by 1922, which we just talked about, the Home Rule Party is gone from the south of Ireland.
There was a slow decline of the Irish Parliamentary Party, going right back to the turn of the century, let's say. And that the party became corrupt, it became bloated, and it ceased to function effectively, and therefore the party gradually outlived its shelf life in Parliament, particularly when the Home Rule question stagnated from 1912 onwards, where it was placed on the statute book and then nothing happened. The other hypothesis, and the one that I would lean more towards myself, is that this was a crisis-driven fall. So the two major crises that occur are the First World War, as the most decisive event in modern Irish history, or in 20th century Irish history, and then the 1916 Rising, which can be seen as almost a constituent part of the First World War. The change in public opinion that occurred after the 1916 Rising occurred not over a year, but immediately and rapidly. It occurred in May and June of 1916. Martial law and its extension across the country, particularly to areas that had seen no fighting and had been entirely loyal and weren't harbouring any enemies of the state, these were still put under martial law along with the rest of the country, and this caused massive local resentment. Similarly, the execution of the leaders of the Rising caused public revulsion. And the third factor, which is often forgotten, is some of the atrocities that were committed by the British during the 1916 Rising, most notably the murder of Francis Sheehy Skeffington in what is now called Brill Barracks, previously Portobello Barracks. All these things had a real galvanising effect on the public, and they changed their entire perception of the political situation, and Sinn Féin became popular overnight. Of course, Sinn Féin hadn't organised the rebellion, but Sinn Féin were the political inheritors of the rebellion. The Home Rule Party wasn't entirely vanquished in 1917. There's one train of thought that says that the by-elections of 1917 and 1918 indicate that a resounding Sinn Féin victory was on the cards, and that the general election result of 1918, which saw only six Home Rule MPs and 73 Sinn Féin MPs returned, that was almost an inevitability. I would argue that wasn't the case. Certainly with the conscription crisis, when the Home Rule Party come out as strong against conscription as any other group in Irish society, and we would include within that Sinn Féin, the Church, proto-Irish Labour organisations, all these different organisations coalesced in a grand alliance against conscription, and they were ultimately successful. So the Irish Parliamentary Party had a late revival in 1918, particularly from April onwards. The death of John Redmond and the arrival of John Dillon to the chairmanship of the Irish Parliamentary Party is something which nobody has yet done any really extensive work on. But John Dillon took on some of the attributes of Sinn Féin at that period. He advocated abstention from Parliament. He said that if Britain is going to introduce conscription, we will not be party to this and we won't attend Parliament anymore. So he began to, you know, adopt some of these Sinn Féin tactics moving up to the 1918 general election. The election result in 1918 wasn't as inevitable, let's say, but it was decisive when it did come. The party had allowed its grassroots organisation to slip. There hadn't been an election, general election, since December of 1910. So 8 years without a general election means that very little was done at grassroots level. Similarly, the wartime conditions allowed for the constituency basis of the Irish Parliamentary Party to become less effective at its primary job, which was to get the vote out. We shouldn't see 1918 as an inevitability, but certainly that crisis-driven decline, going back to the Rising and Redmond's disastrous fusion of Irish constitutional nationalism with the war effort, these two things drove people in their droves away from the Irish Parliamentary Party.
Let's say a vote against the war, against conscription, we've got a vote against repression after the Rising. Another factor, though, maybe is that 1918 was the first election in Ireland ever with universal suffrage, or almost universal suffrage, as we would understand it. And it was also the first one where the Irish Parliamentary Party had real competition in almost every constituency.
I think the suffrage question is a key one, however, not in a women's suffrage sense. Certainly the Irish Parliamentary Party were anti-women's suffrage. Certainly John Redmond was, anyway. Individual opinions of MPs differed. And famously, the dissident Tim Healy was a great advocate of women's suffrage. So someone outside the Irish Parliamentary Party was one of the key advocates. However, the women's vote, I don't think, was the decisive vote. The more important thing, I think, is that a new generation existed in 1918. This was a generation that hadn't voted for a long period of time. In 1918, that was 8 years since the last general election, and therefore there was a large section of society who were young, who chafed against the fact that they weren't within the clientelist Irish Parliamentary Party system. There was a generation in 1912 who looked forward to becoming the new ascendancy of Irish life. These were university graduates from this university, from University College Dublin, they saw themselves as being some of the key inheritors of the state. They look forward to having a key role circulating around College Green and being the parliamentary assistants, the parliamentary secretaries, the draftsmen, and the lobbyists of the new parliament. Similarly, there were a cohort of people who wanted to get into the Irish Parliamentary Party and form part of that new parliament on a parliamentary level. But the people who had been in the Gaelic League, who had been influenced by cultural nationalism, were coming into their own in this period. And Labour is very difficult to ascertain where they stood in 1918, because Labour famously stood aside and said that Labour could wait. And by waiting in that election and allowing Sinn Féin to represent the entire dissident vote, it's very hard to work out what Labour actually stood for and where Labour was in that period. Certain members of the Irish Parliamentary Party, notably William Field in Dublin and Joseph Devlin in West Belfast, painted themselves as Labour representatives, even though they weren't Labour representatives in the same way that a Connolly or a Larkin was. They were very different. But the Irish Parliamentary Party did try and consume Labour like it had tried to consume so many other movements before, largely unsuccessfully.
Certainly for the next 3 years or 4 years, you have, let's say, the Republican generation, which is another story, really. Mm. But the Irish Party had a long afterlife, and strangely enough, in the north of Ireland.
Oh, absolutely. The Irish Party doesn't go away until the 1960s with the Civil Rights Movement, really. You could draw strands of continuity between Joseph Devlin, who retains his West Belfast seat right up until his death in the 1930s, 1934, and then moving on from that, subsequent nationalist politicians in the north of Ireland. But certainly the Nationalist Party fuse with the old Sinn Féin in the north of Ireland in this period. Cathair Healy representing a more rural Ulster Sinn Féin radicalism, and then Joe Devlin representing that more urban, working class, nationalist vote, which had formerly been so well controlled by the Irish Parliamentary Party. They fused to form the basis of nationalist opposition to the Ulster state as it's created in the 1920s.
And in the south of Ireland, I mean, you do see some people from the parliamentary tradition coming back into politics after the Civil War.
You do indeed, yes. Most famously, John Redmond's son, William Archer Redmond, had been an officer in the First World War, and he returned to his father's seat in Waterford City in 1918 and won a by-election, before the general election of 1918, retaining his father's seat in the Redmond name. And John Redmond's ancestors had held that seat going back to the 1860s at least. So that was one politician, William Archer Redmond, forming his own small party in the late 1920s, is one of the interesting stories of interwar Irish politics. But there were other Irish Parliamentary Party candidates. Lawrence Ginnell going into Sinn Féin, James O'Mara and Kilkenny had a certain role in politics after 1922. They were political animals, and they adapted well. They proved adaptable prior to 1918, and anyone who survived proved adaptable after 1918. Tim Healy, not someone who we could talk of as Irish Parliamentary Party in any sense. He's always the dissident of this story, but he becomes the Governor General of the Free State and has a prominent role in the maintenance of links between the old traditions and the new traditions of the state.
So what is the legacy of the Home Rule Party? Are they failures because they didn't get what they wanted? Or did they bring Irish politics into the modern era? How do you see that?
I would err towards your second point, that they bring Ireland into the modern era. I think if you're looking for the legacy of the Irish Parliamentary Party, it won't be found in statues or great personal legacies. The legacy of the Irish Parliamentary Party is a legacy of political culture. And that's not really a positive legacy in many senses. Clientelism was invented by the Irish Parliamentary Party in an Irish sense. The whole idea of the caucus, which was perfected by the Irish Parliamentary Party with their conventions of the United Irish League, it's an ordeche of the modern era. It's where a small cohort of individuals are able to exist as wire pullers and use action and the mandate of a large gathering of people to bring forward the opinions of a much smaller cohort. And that's something that exists in Irish politics. Patronage is something else that the Irish Parliamentary Party were very strong on. There are many letters from this period asking for quite menial jobs, from harbour master to, let's say, a kitchen assistant in an asylum or something like that. These are all jobs that Irish Parliamentary Party MPs lobby to get for their own constituents and for people that have asked to intercede on their behalf. So there's a lot of lobbying, there's a lot of intercession, and there's a lot of patronage being doled out by the Irish Parliamentary Party. And that's one of their big legacies. And then again, going back to the personnel of Irish politics, at a period when politicians weren't paid, and in Britain, politicians were largely people with independent means, whether they be landowners of the Tory party or industrialists of the Liberal party. These were the people who populated politics in both islands in the late Victorian period. The Irish Parliamentary Party changed all that, and working on a model which arguably Daniel O'Connell had started with Catholic rent, by fundraising, particularly of the Irish diaspora, they were able to fund their own candidates, and the candidates were paid by the party. Now, this did two things. First of all, it led to rigid parliamentary discipline, because even though you've set a pledge that you're going to sit, act and vote with the party, the key thing is that the party pays your wage at the end of the day. So if you don't toe the party line, you're going home with nothing. The role of publicans and local shopkeepers in Irish politics in the 1920s, the 1930s, and right up to today, as well as journalists, I'm not singling out publicans here, but publicans, journalists and local shopkeepers entered into Irish politics in the 1880s. Sean O'Fallon's novel, The Nest of Simple Folk, gives a good account of a Rathkeel publican in the 1890s and his involvement with nationalist politics. This is something that is familiar right up to the present day in Irish political life. They instigated this, the role of local magnates into political life and their dominance of political culture. What the Irish Parliamentary Party don't have, which exists in the modern Irish state, is teachers. There aren't many teachers in the Irish Parliamentary Party for whatever reason. And indeed, it's actually Sinn Féin that has a much more teacher-orientated cohort within its own parliamentarians, thinking of Eamon de Valera. Pádraig Pearse, if he had survived, would be another teacher who would have been involved in Irish politics, no doubt, in a later period. And we can see the role of teachers going right through. But solicitors is another one that the Irish Parliamentary Party began to bring into politics. But I think that's more natural that solicitors involve themselves in politics.
Okay, Conor Mulva, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
That was Dr. Conor Mulva talking to John Dorney about the history of the Irish Parliamentary Party. Thank you for listening to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name is Cathal Brennan, and if you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, check us out on the Near FM podcast page or go to our Facebook page on www.facebook.com/The Irish History Show.